From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. A month ago, we visited one of our favorite spots, the library. You know, at the ACLU, we love a good library. So much so that we even spent a recent Saturday night at the Brooklyn Public Library along with some 5,000 others for their annual enrichment event, Night in the Library. I'm telling you, libraries are hot right now. The theme for this year's event was Out of Darkness, and it included an all-night lineup of performances and conversations focused on what it means to face hardship head-on, and what we gain from confronting life's challenges with honesty, curiosity, and understanding. When we were invited to host a conversation during the event, we knew immediately who we wanted to share with our neighbors in Brooklyn. Joining me tonight is my neighbor in Brooklyn. It's so perfect. Ian Manuel. Give it up for Ian.
Thank you. Thank you.
You might remember Ian from our episode back in January when he joined us to talk about juvenile life without parole, solitary confinement, and restorative justice. Ian is an author, poet, activist, and absolute visionary, working to change our criminal legal system after facing 18 years in solitary confinement himself and 26 years in prison, beginning when he was only 14 years old. He knows firsthand what it's like to face darkness in life and come out of it.
It's a level of torture. The United Nations says that over 15 days in solitary confinement is considered torture. Well, right. Imagine sitting in that cell, not for 15 days, but for 18 consecutive years, the weeks just bleed into months, and the months became years, and the years became decades. And it's not like they just left you there and left you alone. No, the psychological torture, the gassing with high-powered chemical agents, the repeated beatings, the injection with psychotropic meds, the screams. And the only reason I was able to sustain myself was the belief that I would not die in prison. And I dived into the depth of my imagination and I lost myself in my poetry.
This belief and journey into the depths of his imagination is a practice that Ian refers to as magical thinking. This is the idea that we used as the basis for our Night in the Library conversation. And with it being both National Library Week and National Poetry Month right now, I can't think of a better time to share it. So I invite you to cozy up with us between the bookshelves and enjoy the highlights from The Light of Magical Thinking. Live from the Brooklyn Public Library. So we're going to start tonight with what Ian is known for and what he does best. So Ian, if you don't mind, would you share If I Told My Story with us?
Sure. If I told my story, would you believe a word I said? Or would the truth be like a square root? Too deep and difficult to understand. If I told my story, in all the times I've bled, how I played hopscotch over blood drops, a result of a childhood curtailed in a cell. If I told my story of the water splashing closed eyelids like a dam, 1 million tears that never spilled, a wounded heart just waiting to heal. If I told my story, of courage and my will to act in spite of my fears, how I survived being buried alive, you probably wouldn't believe your ears. If I told my story of guts and glory without sugarcoating the facts, it would be obvious without much argument that I've lived a miraculous life if I told my story.
Whew. Thank you. Thank you. I told you that he's really good at this. Ian is a performer. He lights up a crowd. But before Ian was a performer in front of an audience, he was a writer in solitude, spending hours, days, months wandering his own mind. During his confinement, Ian became a poet, studying the works of other great poets by writing and rewriting their poetry to practice, paying attention to the form. He then got the courage to write his own.
I wrote this poem, Genie in the Bottle, in solitary confinement when I was still a young man discovering myself. I thought I had a gift, and I nurtured it by challenging myself. So I wrote this poem, Genie in the Bottle, and I read it to my fellow prisoners. And hopefully the response I got from them will be similar to the one I get from you tonight. I'm the genie in the bottle. The world has forgot. They put me in this abyss and closed up the top. I was a little boy when they did what they did, but time continued to tick, and I'm no longer a kid. My mother is dead, and so is my father. I've been abandoned by family while trapped in this bottle, but I hold on to hope that someone will open the top, answer my prayers, and help me out. Sometimes people pick up the bottle and put their eye to the hole. But instead of compassion, acting different and cold, I suffer sensory deprivation, a lost sense of direction. There's no mirror in this bottle for me to see my reflection. They say being lonely and alone are two different definitions. But it's only me in this bottle, so I fit both descriptions. What I need is a friend, someone to extend a hand. It could be as simple as picking up a pen. Someone who cares, accepts me for who I am. My magnetic personality and my baggage from the past. Someone who helps heal the sorrow, will work on building our tomorrows. Someone who refuses to leave me to die in this bottle. Thank you.
You've told me that while in solitary, and you actually wrote this in your book, that you cherished your aloneness. You were rarely bored, spending hours of time imagining, practicing magical thinking, which is why we're all here, and I'm really excited to get into this part of our conversation. What is magical thinking to you, and where did this take up root in your life?
I think magical thinking is just a place where dreams come true in your own head. And you have to believe in these unseen things so fervently that you feel like you can will them into existence. That's what magical thinking is to me.
And I feel like this magical thinking is an incredible strength of yours. It seems really simple and also really complicated at the same time. So we're going to break it down. You've told me a number of times that we've spoken that you always believed more for yourself, which I think is really core and central to magical thinking. Tell me how you kept this belief and sense of self, that you were destined for bigger and better things, that you were going to get out of prison despite every external factor telling you otherwise?
That's a tough question, but I think...
Who planted that in you?
Well, my mom planted it in me. We didn't have the best of relationships, but it's one thing she did when I was a child. It was a consistent statement that she would make that I held on to, and that was, Ian, you're brilliant. No matter what, don't never let them take your mind. Mm. Now, I don't know who these people were that were supposed to come and just take my mind.
Right.
But when I was in prison in solitary and I was had to combat and fight for my sanity, I saw who those people were.
Yeah.
And I saw how they treated people who didn't have their minds.
Right.
And so I felt like my mind was my last line of defense against insanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to make up these stories and these dreams. And all it is, it boils down to action and set an intention for that action. That is the core of what magical thinking is.
In our conversation, we explored just exactly what Ian means when he says he practices magical thinking and how we can all apply magical thinking to our own lives. Ian walked us through a few examples where he's seen magical thinking serve his life beyond all of his expectation. He credits his release from prison, despite being given a life without parole sentence as a child, to the power of his magical thinking. When you were in prison, you wrote a letter to then-Senator of Florida, Bill Nelson, telling him your story, asking him for help. Everyone knows when people tell us to reach out to our representatives, we feel like we are sending something into a dark black hole that might never get seen. That can be easy to feel, but you still believed that your letter could do something for you. Tell me about that experience.
I wrote Senator Nelson a letter about my case previously.
Mm.
And he wrote me back and he said, I'm in the federal branch. We have to stay separate from state issues. He said, however, if there's ever anything else in the future that I can help you with, please don't hesitate to contact my office.
And you weren't just like discouraged by that?
Nah. I mean, I put the letter away or whatever, but I also put it in the back of my mind, that statement. Now, that statement is probably something, just a generic statement that they put on every letter.
It probably is.
Right? But I held on to
it. You believed in it.
I believed in that same statement that he made. Like, why would he tell me this? So when an opportunity came to actually call him on it, that mm-hmm. about something that wasn't a state thing, I called him and I sent him a letter. And basically the letter was me saying, Senator Nelson, I've been in solitary confinement since I was a 15-year-old child. I said, I'm 32 going on 33. My birthday is March 29th. And I'm about to be 33 years old. And I have been in solitary for so long. I'm hurting myself in solitary and nobody's doing anything. They're just telling me to die.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is America. It shouldn't be like this. Well, Senator Nelson got my letter and did something that I set the intention that if I told the truth and connected with him in a truthful way, that it would do something. He sent my letter to the head of the Department of Corrections. And the head of the Department of Corrections in Florida got with the warden at my prison and they developed a plan. And 6 months later, after that letter, I mean, I was immediately taken from the most restrictive form of solitary and placed in the least restrictive form of solitary
mm-hmm.
from CM1 to CM3. That's what right. happened immediately. But they didn't want to just let me out of confinement immediately after being in a cell for 18 years. They wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to hurt anybody. And so they gave me trustee duties for 6 months. And then they released me to open population. So that letter had the desired effect.
Mm-hmm.
And after 18 years of people thinking I was going to die in a cell, I walked out of solitary confinement.
Wow.
And ran to the canteen. Thank you.
Ian also credits this way of thinking for the reconciliation he found with the woman he had shot when he was just 13 years old, Debbie Bakery. Shooting Debbie is how Ian found himself incarcerated. Ever since that day, he wanted to make amends with Debbie, so he made it happen, believing if he called her, she would answer.
Well, I always had like a childlike imagination, and I visualized myself. First of all, I wasn't raised to hurt people.
Of course.
Right. And so I wanted the opportunity to apologize for what I had done because I didn't intend to hurt her that night.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did something that the inmates in the dormitory told me I was crazy for. It's something any lawyer would not recommend for their client to reach out to the victim of their crime.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it because in my mind, she was gonna accept a collect call from the kid.
Yeah.
Shot her.
Yeah.
Doing a robbery.
Yeah.
And I believed that fervently.
Yeah.
And I walked out to the compound where they kept all the phones, and I picked up the phone. And back then, many of you guys are old enough to remember when all you had to do was press zero, and an operator would come on the line. And
that was a quick judgment on the age of the audience.
I mean,
it's okay.
You got to
okay,
be like 30 at least. So I pressed zero, and the operator asked me, What do you call that? Ian. A collect call from Ian to Debbie. Yeah. And she put the call through. The phone rung. And Debbie accepted the collect call. And the first thing I said, it was during Christmas. And I said, I'd like to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas and to apologize for what I did, for shooting you a year ago downtown Tampa. And then Debbie asked me a question that no child should ever have to answer. She said, Ian, why did you shoot me?
Mm.
And I said, it all happened so fast. I'm sorry, it was a mistake. And we talked, and I can't remember the rest of the conversation, but the key part of that conversation was I asked her, could I write her? And she said, yes. And I did. And she wrote back. And
again,
she forgave me.
Yeah. And then you built a relationship.
Yes.
And have met.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's incredible the kind of change Ian created in his life simply by believing it possible, because he had no reason to believe it in the first place. But here's the thing about imagination. It changes how we act because we start to believe and pursue possibility. We often talk at the ACLU about how we reform complex systems, especially when their roots are so entrenched in the foundings of our country. But it all begins with the simple act of imagination. Or, in other words, magical thinking. Don't believe me? I get it. Ian, when people are like, okay, I hear you, but you're you, I'm me, maybe that's just working in your life, or I don't really believe you, or you make it sound so simple because all I have to do is like believe that it could happen and it. Then I do the thing and I put it out into the world and it happens. That's literal magic. What do you say to doubters?
I say you're not listening hard enough to the voice that's inside you.
Ooh, okay. Say more.
Sometimes it's all you have to do, man. I think everybody in this room has that inner voice that talks to them, that compels them to do something. Then they'll either share it with somebody or listen to the other side of their brain that says, no, that's a stupid idea. That'll never work. Mm-hmm. It won't happen. Mm-hmm. And so you never act on it.
Right.
Had I listened to that voice of the doubters, I would have never called Debbie. Had I never listened to that inner voice, I'd have never wrote Senator Nelson.
I hear you.
And my life would be a lot less fun.
Yeah.
And a lot more painful had I not listened to that inner voice.
Right.
So I encourage everybody to listen to that voice inside. Don't quiet that voice that's inside you, compelling you to chase this dream. It's not a stupid dream. It's not unreasonable. I was sitting in prison, sentenced to die there as a child, told that I would never get out of prison. I'm an author now. I'm a published author. They're going to do a documentary about my life, then a movie. Like,
Yeah.
Like, if I can do it, what's stopping you?
That's right.
Ask yourself that question.
Through poetry and magical thinking, Ian has met unfathomable suffering with light. It's in his story that I find hope for us individually and as a country, that we can meet our seemingly insurmountable challenges with reflection and imagination. In Ian's last poem, he shares a vision for his life that he did not know possible, but has been proven possible in his release in the years since.
I want to preface this poem. I wrote this poem in a suicide observation cell, not because I was suicidal, but all I had was a wrap, a pen, a piece of a short pencil, and a piece of paper. And I had just been re-sentenced When I went back to court, the judge nullified my life sentence, but in place gave me 65 years after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned my life sentence. And so I went back to that prison, depressed, stressed, but I had to find the strength to keep going. So I wrote this poem that I want to share with you guys called My Time Will Come. I promise you, the brunt of my oppression has a purpose. And this same person that you persecute will one day be worshipped. Though I stand before you bare-chested and shirtless, with my soul and emotions naked, just wanting to be nurtured. Yeah, despite the desperation, desertion, and hurting, my time gonna come. Though I composed this poem not knowing if I'll ever be able to perform it in an auditorium, I do it with the faith of a poet who believes he was born to do it. Like an acorn caught up in a storm, flung from the branch where it was born. You can only hold me back for so long. My time gonna come. Despite the difficulties and disappointments, my determination remains undaunted. Though the waters of my tomorrows are deep and uncharted, the buoyance of my character will float unwavering towards them. Like a song written, yet unrecorded, my time gonna come. Though you wrapped me in chains and sprayed me with chemical flames and did all of the things you did to add to my pain, my circumstances will change. I believe this with the depths of my being, that as long as this world continues to spin, it cannot end till it's been enjoyed by Ian. Remember this day, because things won't always be this way. My time gonna come. My time gonna come. Against all conceivable odds, my time gonna come. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Ian Manuel for joining us again, and to Brooklyn Public Library for inviting us to your event. You can check out more from At Liberty and Ian in our archive. And you can also pick up Ian's memoir, appropriately titled My Time Will Come. We hope you enjoyed this special live conversation and that it inspired you to maybe do a little magical thinking of your own, too. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seismeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by the good folks at Ultraviolet Audio. Genesis Magpayo is our intern.